MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
And I'm Michael Isikoff.
And welcome to Spy Talk. We want to talk a little bit about this Ratcliffe trip to Moscow. But first, I should know something we haven't heard from is the ODNI and Jay Clayton. And I think that's a good thing that we haven't heard anything out of the ODNI. But anyway, on to John Ratcliffe's mystery trip to Moscow. What do you make of it?
Well, look, there's a long history of CIA directors going to Moscow, a long history of U.S. officials giving warnings to the Russians and Putin himself to cut something out. That's what Obama did, allegedly said to Putin at a G8 summit in China in 2016 when the Russians were caught meddling in the 2016 presidential election. It's what Bill Burns, then the CIA director, said to Putin in 2022. We know what you're up to, amassing troops to invade Ukraine. Cut it out. Obviously, such warnings had zero effect on Vladimir Putin. So I don't know what warning Ratcliffe was giving the Russians. He didn't get to meet with Putin at all. So I think count me dubious that this is going to have any effect on Russian behavior.
Yeah, but I just do think it has an effect on how the world perceives the United States, which is right now not in the best of light in terms of who it's sharing information with, who it's talking to. And I just kind of wonder how, and I've heard some, you know, echoes of this, how European powers are viewing this, and not just Ukraine, but Europe in itself, like what actually is going on between the United States and Russia. And this is not a new question, but the secrecy surrounding this, the amount of fissure points that are in the world right now, I think it's a sign of a Europe that's retreating from any kind of trust in the United States anyway. It's just one extra piece in that direction.
Well, the Europeans have the most to worry about at the moment because there's been a really dramatic escalation in the Russian hybrid war against Europe.
That's right.
Lengthy story in the Washington Post, co-authored by Catherine Belton, about how a drone packed with explosives was found at the Leipzig airport in Germany, and Russia is the prime suspect. And this fits into a really alarming series of actions. I'm just reading a couple of graphs from that story that leapt out at me. European security officials and former senior German officials said the incident, this is the drone with the explosives at the airport, fits a clear pattern of likely Russian aggression that is playing out across Europe. Weapons facilities supplying Ukraine in Italy, Bulgaria, Estonia, and Slovakia have faced mysterious explosions, fires, and arson attempts this month.
I picked up a report for my weekly Spy Week Roundup about that the Kremlin is recruiting local gang members to sabotage defense manufacturers across Europe to test NATO's resolve. That came from the Telegraph in London. It went on to say, this week, Latvia detained three of its own nationals on suspicions of an arson attack against a drone manufacturer in Estonia. The attacks appear carefully calculated to fall just short of triggering Article 5, NATO's mutual defense clause.
So the question is, what do we do about it?
Well, it would be good to shore up our alliance with NATO members, and that's very fuzzy.
Yeah.
Just for starters, there has been indications since the beginning of this administration that their trust in American intelligence has been withering because they see politicization coming from the White House into the intelligence agencies, and they fear that, well, they're just,
you know, I get that, but what is an appropriate response by NATO or the U.S., which is a part of NATO, to this really sharp escalation in Russian malign activity in Europe?
Well, the head of MI6, her name escapes me at the moment.
Blaise Metrivelli.
Oh, yes, thanks.
Metrivelli, yeah.
She made a very aggressive speech or very aggressive remarks in her debut speech as MI6 head, saying, we're going to take it to you. See how you like it.
So we do the same things inside Russia, you know, bombings, arson.
Well, in a way, we're partners. Say what you will about Trump's, and there's plenty to say about Trump's lack of backing for Ukraine. But according to all reporting, we are still robustly involved with Ukrainian intelligence and targeting facilities inside Russia for Ukrainian missiles and drones. So in a way, we are, you know, as a one-off, part of the response to Russia. But you're right, that's a really good question. How do you respond to that kind of clandestine sabotage? We're back in World War II kind of.
But except for in World War II, we did have a close alliance with Europe. And that alliance is being systematically weakened from their point of view, forgetting about from our point of view, and with a sense of this isn't just about one president and this isn't going to be so easy to fix. And they have to take care of themselves. And who knows what that'll mean in terms of alliances, et cetera, down the road, or even now. For us.
Yeah. Well, in World War II, we had a close alliance with the Brits. The rest of Europe had been taken over by the Nazis.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, exactly. Right.
Anyway, finally.
But we knew whose side we were on.
Yeah, and at least that.
Yeah.
Finally, I just want to say in passing, I got an announcement from the Department of Justice this morning that an employee of the Defense Intelligence Agency is the DIA's Insider Threat Department. Has pleaded guilty to offering secrets to an unidentified foreign intelligence agency. This guy was in the insider threat division at DIA.
Ironically, I think the story I read said, it quoted officials, you know, on background saying it was the Germans he was selling the intelligence to, which is, you know, not exactly a hostile intelligence service.
You know the old saying, there are friendly countries, but there are no friendly intelligence agencies. Right. So anyway, finally, NBC reporting today that, or very recently, that the attacks on buildings in the Middle East were far more damaging by the Iranians than has been previously reported. That the CIA station in Riyadh was seriously damaged. Surveillance equipment in the Middle East, across the Middle East region at U.S. bases, has caused unprecedented damage for the CIA and other U.S. spy agencies. That's what NBC is saying. Any thoughts on that, Karen?
Yeah, my thoughts are, how many things can we fail at the same time? No, I'm serious. I mean, at some point, it has to be, why weren't we prepared? Why didn't we defend ourselves? These are the questions we asked ourselves, you know, on 9/11 and after 9/11. And what actually is going on in the world? And, you know, the problem with that is you talk about what's going on in the world as if there's a plan. But what we're seeing more is just sort of one-offs here, there, elsewhere. And actually, they may actually be connected in ways that we're not noticing and not thinking. So what do I think of it? I think it's frightening.
Just one other observation on that is, I mean, if the Iranians are targeting clandestine U.S. intelligence facilities in the Middle East, including the CIA station in Riyadh, they must have pretty good intel about where these stations are, who's in them, and what they're doing, which I find sort of a bit alarming on its face.
Well, the Iranians have even inveigled Israelis into spying. So this is this is intelligence wars. This is what it's about. And we're almost on we made a reference to World War II. There's a lot about this that is really reminiscent of World War II clandestine operations on a less than war footing. Of course, we're not officially at war with Iran, but we are What are we with Iran right now? It's hard to say.
Economic D-Day this week?
What you mean
bring
is...
bring them to their knees.
That's Infrastructure Week, I thought. Anyway, let's get on to our guest. Steve Hirsch served in senior leadership positions across the CIA in counterterrorism and intelligence analysis, in workforce issues, including post-9/11 organizational changes. Following 9/11, he served as a presidential daily briefer, which means that he was part of the briefing team, but he also briefed many cabinet officials following the 9/11 attacks and their agencies. He also led CIA Public Affairs, the FLAX, who defend the agency and try to give explanations for when things don't go right. And he led the agency's business analytics transformation. He also served in senior counterterrorism and Middle East crisis roles earlier in his career, analyzed chemical and biological weapons, which is kind of a favorite subject of his. And that's a wide range of experience. So without hesitation, let's bring him on. Welcome, Steve Hirsch. You served in several senior positions across the agency, and we want to talk to you about those various things. But first, I want to ask you about John Ratcliffe's supposedly secret visit to Moscow, which, of course, we all know about now because it was picked up by a flight tracker at the Washington Post. I was just wondering whether you had ever been involved in any of these so-called secret trips by CIA directors abroad, and whether you think it's possible to keep them secret now in this world of surveillance.
Well, hello. So first of all, they're secret, so I can't tell you whether or not I was involved in them. But what I will tell you is it was fascinating to me. The most interesting thing about all of this is how quickly we all knew about this. I mean, it was amazing. The Washington Post, but there's all kinds of other across the globe. There's all kinds of other trackers that were reporting not only on the airplane, but on all kinds of other movements around the Moscow airport and around, the Air Force airports. So I think the question that the agency and frankly, all of the intelligence communities need to ask is what are we going to do about this? Because these are usually classified until a long time afterwards. They're leaked, but this is no longer really an option for them. Now, the question is, sometimes I would suspect, and you know, the agency using people to go overseas is actually goes way back in history, where presidents have sent heads of CIA over to talk, particularly to senior Russian and Soviet officials.
Right? Michael Hayden talked about it extensively in his book, Playing to the Edge, which I reviewed for the New York Times. And he told me in a conversation one day that he felt like he spent half his time visiting his counterparts abroad.
Yeah. First of all, Director Hayden was great. I loved working for him. But it's fascinating why we send these folks. And that's really a political question around what the president or the National Security Council wants. But more interesting, why now? And that's the question I keep asking people is, why do you think now? And I think if you look across the globe, there are a number of reasons. And frankly, I don't know why he went over there. I've been out of the agency far too long for that. But if you look at it, we've got Iran, we've got Ukraine, and the history, and I think Director Hayden talked about this, is these are generally used to, A, maintain open levels of communication, because that level of communication, intelligence agency to intelligence agency, intelligence services to intelligence services, has always remained open even in the most dark times.
Well, there's been widespread reporting that Ratcliffe went there to tell the Russians to keep their hands off the Baltics and other places. There seems to be unanimity on that. That's been leaked out pretty strongly.
Right. And I would, as someone who's worked in the agency for 30 years, I would say that leaked out fairly quickly, and now it's widespread. I often wonder when those things happen.
I mean, the reasons for the trip were obviously right. Someone in the administration is briefing reporters on the purpose of the trip, or the alleged purpose of the trip.
And that's what I think is the purpose of the trip.
Right.
Right. Is this just another way of the administration to signal what it wants to signal?
But just as a follow-up to this, Steve, the last time a CIA director went to Moscow, it was Bill Burns on the eve of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and he was warning them not to do it. And he met with Putin. Radcliffe did not meet with Putin. It's not clear who he met with. What does that tell you on its face?
Well, the interesting thing is when you had Burns going over to Moscow, he met with Putin. Radcliffe does not meet with Putin. What does Putin do almost several months after he meets with Burns?
He invades Ukraine.
Bingo. So the question is, how effective is it actually meeting with Putin versus maybe Radcliffe meeting with his counterpart over there?
Well, it seems like a deliberate snub.
If the purpose was to do a warning, yeah, because, you know, if you're going to warn somebody, you want to warn the top guy, not one of his underlings. But then again, you know, does Putin respond to U.S. warnings? He didn't when Obama told him to cut it out in 2016, referring to the Russian cyber attacks on the U.S. presidential election. And obviously he didn't respond when Burns warned him not to invade Ukraine. So
what's the warning? What's going on?
What's the or else?
Yeah.
Well, you know, everybody's talking now about the Balkans. You just mentioned the Balkans, but I suspect that it also had to do with Ukraine. And then, in my opinion, and again, I had nothing to do with any of this. In my opinion, there was probably some signaling going on with red lines around Russia. Iran.
Or Russians helped to. Iran and targeting. There's been some reporting saying that the Russians are using their satellite intelligence to help the Iranians target U.S. Intelligence facilities and allies in the Middle East.
I would think that would probably be the most likely reason. And that would be the most likely reason you'd send a Radcliffe over there to meet specifically with his counterpart, as opposed to meeting with a Putin. And the only other thing I'll say about meeting with a head of state, like meeting with Putin or meeting with Trump, is there's all of the things that go into meeting with someone like that, right? There's all the security. And even if it's classified, there's still going to be a lot of people involved. When you meet security head to security head, it's a much smaller organization. It's a much smaller security footprint. And you can usually keep those secret for a far, far longer. But again, I go back to what I said before. I think the fascinating story out of all of this, because the Russians will or won't heed whatever Radcliffe said. If history, particularly recent history, is any kind of a tell, they're probably listened, shook their heads, and they're going to continue to do whatever they're going to continue to do. I think that there's real implications here, though, about how many people knew this almost before Radcliffe landed on the ground. That's crazy.
Would you guess that they told the Europeans ahead of time that they were going to do this?
I thought there was reporting that they had told the Ukrainians already.
Well, the Estonians, interestingly, remarked afterwards that nothing changed. I mean, you can talk to them all you want, but
yeah.
I mean, let's move on to another subject, Steve. When your representative reached out to me, she said she listed the top thing that you like to discuss would be the threats America may be underestimating and how intelligence professionals distinguish headline-grabbing risks from vulnerabilities that deserve greater attention. What do you mean by that?
So I think that there's, for me, there's always, and this has been my experience in the agency, there's always, what are the headlines? For me, the bigger danger is what's on the second page, what's after the fold. Okay, so for example, everybody's now talking about Iran, everybody's talking about Ukraine. Well, actually, everybody's now talking about Radcliffe going to Moscow, right? But for me, the bigger question becomes, what is the threat that we are facing, and what are our adversaries, particularly the Russians, the Iranians, and the Chinese, specifically the Chinese, what are they gaining from how we have struggled with responding to a lot of these foodborne illnesses lately? That's terrifying to me. because we are falling all over ourselves. And these are fairly easy things to tackle. Salmonella and the chlorospora and all the rest of these things, right? We have failed miserably. And if I'm a Chinese analyst or I'm a Russian analyst, I am watching how badly we are responding to these things domestically. Right? How badly we're communicating that to the American public and what that means for the way that they could exploit these. It also shows that we have no way of really going back and looking at all of the sort of chain of custody that goes all the way from the lettuce, or I guess it's the peppers that are in your Giant or your Safeway, all the way back to where they were grown. It's extremely difficult to do that. And we're basically telegraphing this. So for me, those threats are the things that nobody's really paying attention to. You know that people are getting sick, but no one is paying attention to the fact that these folks are actually watching this carefully and showing how unbelievably incapable we are of dealing with even these kinds of things.
So putting on top of that is you add AI into the picture and the threat that AI might break out on its own and create a biological weapon or be used to create a biological weapon. What's your take on the threat level of that?
Of AI creating a biological weapon? So I think it's
yikes.
I don't think we're there yet where it's going to create a biological weapon, but I will tell you, you know, actually create the thing, but it is certainly doing its job in finding every single piece of information that is pointing to what are the weaknesses. And it's not just biological weapon for humans. I think we all immediately go to biological weapons for humans, but look at the catastrophe. I keep going back to the biological element here. Think about what if AI created a really interesting, really deadly, let's call it a bug, that attacks, we'll just go back to lettuce or avocados, right? Things that lots and lots of people eat. We might not even know about that. If it's going to hit people, that's going to be something we're going to focus on immediately. For me, when you're dealing with these foodborne illness things, there is such an incredibly long tail to actually identifying it and then, you know, being able to respond to it. And we can talk about that in a minute. But for me, that's the bigger threat because people are going to immediately react to people getting sick. Now, you can go back and you can look at what happened with COVID and how we fell all over ourselves there and how now we're dealing with conspiracy theories and differences of information, vaccines yes or vaccines no. But meanwhile, look also how all of that is really dividing this country. Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, they're loving every minute of this. So to get back to your question, though, I'm not really concerned right now that it's going to, on its own, put out a biological weapon that's going to kill Americans or kill people. I am concerned that you could go into AI and with the right prompting, basically come up with an agent that would wipe out, come up with some kind of a resistant rust, for example, and wipe out wineries, for example, in Virginia, and I live in Virginia, I'm from California, wipe out wineries.
So just a follow-up to that, you mentioned how the Russians and the Chinese are watching very closely how we're responding to issues of this sort. But no question, the Russians do lots of really nasty things, and the Chinese do some really aggressive things. But launching a biological weapon against the West, they do operate under some constraints. Does that strike you that either the Russians or Chinese would go that far to do something that obviously would require massive retaliation by the West?
So, I mean, both of those countries have got well-documented chemical and biological weapons programs, particularly biological weapons programs. I mean, we had a chemical agent program, but those programs go back, you know, the Soviet program goes back, frankly, before World War II. The Chinese, pretty much as soon as there was a communist China, they were immediately focusing on chemical and biological weapons. That was almost the mode of the day, is to get into CBW. So they've already done these things. They've already done a lot of research on these things. And so,
well, they also both have nuclear weapons, and, you know, but they haven't used them. But
right. So, you know, one of the reasons why, in my opinion, I may be wrong, but that they didn't use biological weapons was because if you release anthrax on the world, in agents that were identified in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, if you release anthrax on the world, there is going to be, as you have said, a retaliation of unmatched magnitude, right? If we ever found out that the Soviets and now the Russians hit us with anthrax, God help them. I mean, we're going to be in a world of hurt, but God help them, right? But you're in a place now where you can come up with these things that you won't even know. You won't even know. And I keep coming back to the foodborne ones because those are the ones that scare me. You don't even know if this rust that's come out of nowhere. And we have these foodborne illnesses, both for livestock and fruits and vegetables, that do seem to be coming out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden, now they've got a resistance to this or a resistance to that. I'll tell you, and this is just sort of in a way of illustrating. I mean, I live in Virginia. I'm not sure where the rest of you are from, but we are now dealing with these darn lantern flies, right?
Yes.
Look at the damage that those things are already doing. It's a biological agent. They come from Asia and from China. Now, I don't think they introduced them intentionally, but still look at the damage that they've done. Look at the damage that they've done. Now, imagine that you actually do something like that, a mosquito perhaps, that's biologically enhanced so that it's going to have, you know, whatever it is, but it's going to be able to get through all of the sprays, which, you know, is not really that far off.
As engrossing as this is, Steve, we have to take a break for a moment. I want to come back and ask you about the change in the workforce since 9/11. Okay, we're back. The agency swelled with paramilitary types after 9/11. As the conflicts geared up in Afghanistan and Iraq and the hunt for Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so on. And a lot of people think that the character of the workforce at the CIA changed, and not to the good, from that swelling influx of paramilitary types. What do you think about that?
I would not agree. What I would say is after 9/11, because I was there after 9/11, I was there before and then after 9/11. After 9/11, I think that the entire agency and the military, all of the intelligence community, there was a new, very strong resolve. And I think that the bringing on whatever additional paramilitary they may have brought on, and frankly, I don't know those numbers, I think that was all part of the same thing. We all had a mission to do, and we were going to do that mission however we needed to do that mission, and that is find the people that caused that unbelievable devastation and bring them to justice. And I think that you saw that throughout the IC. I know I felt that. I was working crisis parts of the world in South Asia and then in the Middle East, and I felt we had people that were coming in. I'm sure all of you have heard about after 9/11, we had this unbelievable spike in people applying to join the agency because they wanted to be part of the fight. And that's what you had. And I think that the paramilitary folks were just an element of that and added to it. But I don't know that they necessarily changed. Certainly, I didn't feel it. And again, I worked the Middle East. I then went over and worked at NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center, for a couple of years working on threats to the homeland. And you felt that resolve across everyone, whether they had just come from Harvard, whether they were from the FBI, because I managed a bunch of FBI folks, or frankly, whether they were paramilitaries with whom we were working.
I want to follow up on a few things. First of all, the idea of AI, I think you probably saw the op-ed by Jen Easterly, the former head of CISA, that was really an amazing alarm call, which is we are not managing AI really in any way. And, you know, the lights are blinking red and we know we've heard this before and we're telling you this now. So I want to follow up a little bit on Jeff's question about what's happened to the agency, not after 9/11, but now, because we read repeatedly about, you know, it getting smaller and smaller, that people are leaving, that people are being fired, that people aren't being paid when they leave their severance, you know, right? Have you seen these articles? And my question is to you, okay, I hear the alarm bells that you're talking about, and we can focus on bioweapons if you want, but who should be, it's not just about intelligence. It's about coordination, as we learned at 9/11, right? With agencies that have to do with health, that have to do with agriculture, that right? And it has to do with having specific people paying attention to this. So if you were in charge and you were going to say, I know how to do this, this is what we need to set up, or this is who is in place that we need to rely on, who's not doing the job? Or is that we don't have those jobs?
Well, where do I start with this? There's a lot there.
Whatever you want.
So let me start with 9/11. And I think you got my bio. I was actually literally right after 9/11, they brought me up to brief Health and Human Services, Agriculture, and the director of FEMA, which we had never briefed before. And they asked me to brief them because I was a biological weapons analyst. I was following agricultural sorts of things. But I will never forget, they actually said, we need someone to brief these folks who actually understands how to communicate in English, not to use chemical and biological terms. So I went out, and after 9/11, I started to brief those organizations. I don't know if you remember, but after 9/11, I forgot how long after 9/11, we had an anthrax attack, the anthrax mails that were sent to senators and congressmen and I think some press.
National Enquirer.
Oh, yeah, right. And so immediately everyone started scrambling about who's sending this. What I saw, because I was a briefer, I was meeting with the heads of all of those organizations, was an amazing amount of communication, because this is after 9/11. They've already seen where communication didn't work. And you see agriculture, you see Health and Human Services, you see FEMA asking me, their PDB briefer, to go back to the agency and ask for more information, to arrange meetings. They were already working with themselves. That's how it needed to work. That's how it should work. What would I do? So a couple of things. I'm sorry if I'm betraying my politics here, but I actually think that the government could have used some downsizing. My concern is how we ended up doing the downsizing over the past 2 years. I think that there was a lot that could be cut across the entire federal government. I'm not talking about just the intelligence community, but also the intelligence community. There were things that I think that we were following that we probably didn't need to continue to follow anymore, that we should have been moving to follow. But what we saw was just this wholesale cutting, simply because that was what the administration wanted to see, was lots of people leaving. So as a result, you see a lot of people leaving, which then does what? It starts to backlog, because when you have federal employees who leave, they get benefits, and that creates an HR chain, and now you're backed up because you don't have enough HR people, because guess what? They're also leaving.
This becomes a security concern as well. I mean, you don't want to piss off a lot of people with above top secret clearances.
You would think so. You would think that you'd want to take care of people. And I will also tell you, the agency has done an amazing job, in my opinion, of taking care of people when they retire or when they leave, making sure that they do everything. They make
not
sure
according to current reporting. There's a big backlog, and retirees who have been shoved out the door are not getting their benefits.
Exactly.
Correct. And I have friends who are feeling this. In fact, it probably took an extra month or two for me to start to get my benefits. So I'm not saying that what they're saying is not true. What I'm saying is the agency, and I apologize, it used to do a really great job of taking care of people, They want to make sure that you're not going to be a source for the Chinese or the Russians. I would truly be concerned today about people who have not gotten their pension. And that's an agency thing. That's also an OPM thing, who have not gotten their pension, have not gotten their annual leave payouts, and are basically sitting there with no money coming in, getting angrier and angrier and angrier at an organization and a system that is not basically treating them, I would think, fairly. Because these are people 30, 40, 40 years serving the organization, serving the country. Those are people I think need to be taken care of.
I believe I read in your bio that as a PDB briefer, you briefed the president and the vice president as well. Can you give us a sense of what that was like after 9/11 and the kinds of things you were briefing on and the kinds of reactions you got?
Sure. So first of all, I did not brief the president. And this is one of those, I think probably the three of you understand this, but this is a common miscommunication. A PDB briefer is someone who briefs the daily brief, does not necessarily mean for the president. The president authorizes a whole bunch of people to get that briefing. Sometimes they tailor them. I brief the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the Secretary of Agriculture, the Director of FEMA, and then they move me over to brief the Secretary of Homeland Security as he and his team were actually creating that particular organization. I should also say I'm not allowed to tell you the names, but I can tell you what I briefed, so you can do the math. Okay. I also briefed the Secretary of Defense at the time, which was an amazing experience.
Yeah, do tell. It was Donald Rumsfeld. How did that go? Well,
I can't confirm or deny that it was Donald Rumsfeld, okay. But it was after 9/11.
I think it's a public record. I think you're safe there.
Well, Art, tell us about your briefing of the Secretary of Defense.
The Secretary of Defense that I briefed.
In 22.
So I will tell you, incredibly thoughtful.
2001 and 2002.
Sorry. Incredibly thoughtful man. Yeah. Very, very intelligent. But he was one of these briefers, and everyone has a different style. We all have a different style of taking in information. And I was literally giving him and all the rest of the people I briefed a leather binder with paper copies inside it, and they would read it. And we can talk about trying to move over to a tablet and all that kind of stuff, but I would hand him a binder. And then he was the kind of person who wanted to sit and he wanted to read it. So I would sit there. And I would track along. I would try to track along where he was. He would look up and he would ask me a question. And I would say, sir, here's the answer. Or, sir, I don't know that answer. I can get that information for you. I will tell you, and I think that this is well known, he had a nose for people who were BSing him, right? And he would continue to give you enough rope until you hung yourself, right? And so everybody warned me, if he asks you a question you don't have the answer to, the answer is, sir, I don't have that answer, and I can get that for you.
I have
so there
to say
I am.
That it, about the BSing, except that he got BSed big time on Iraq and the alleged connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, which led to this tragic invasion, which is the fruits of which are still with us.
Right. But he asks me, he's reading an article on nuclear submarines, and I have nothing to do with any of that. He asked me a question about, I think, rotor speed or something in cold water. And so he doesn't even look up at me. He asked me this question. I thought, okay, here's the moment. I said, sir, I don't have that answer for you. I can get it for you immediately. And he said, no, tomorrow's fine. He never tried to get me again. I guess I proved that I'm not going to try to BS him. But it was, I found him to be very thoughtful. It was kind of weird because I go in with a tie and a suit, and he came in oftentimes with jeans and like a down vest. It's like, oh, it's dress down day in the Secretary of Defense office.
To something from more recent, which is, I didn't quite get your thought on the robustness, the professionalism, the ability of the CIA at this moment in time to handle the kinds of threats that you were particularly interested in. Do you think that's possible? Are they in touch with the agencies in a useful, the other agencies, in a useful way to be able to combat that? I mean, what's the reason we're not paying attention?
So I think they are, and I think that we have communication. Last I worked those issues, and the friends that I have in the building that are still doing that are still saying that they are communicating with their colleagues and their counterparts. So I'm not necessarily concerned about their ability to continue to do their job. I think it comes down to what are the priorities that obviously the political priorities that the administration and frankly senior leaders are going to be putting out there for them. And again, I haven't been an analyst. I haven't written analysis in probably 15 or 20 years. If I tell you what my analysis is, and it's not going to be my analysis, it's going to be an analysis of a group of people. My name is not even going to appear on that particular document. But if I give you this piece of paper that gives you my analysis, what do you do with it? And that would be my bigger concern, is what are policymakers doing, or frankly not doing, with the intelligence that should be shown to them? And that would be where I would ask the questions. But as far as the agencies doing what they need to do, I think they are doing what they need to do. My second concern comes to when you have all of these cuts and everyone hears these stories about people not being paid or people getting, taking 6-7 months for people to get their pensions, et cetera, et cetera. that's going to start to, in my opinion, affect morale. And so I'm always, and I have always been concerned about our ability to immediately switch and turn to the next thing. And that really requires us to be able to be agile and to get to that new thing. But that also requires us to be in a place where people, frankly, are.
But it also requires a White House willing to listen to what the IC has to say. And we know in the case of the war in Iran that, you know, prior to it, Radcliffe told the president that the idea that the campaign and the killing of the Ayatollah and Confederates would lead to a regime change was farcical. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that Tulsi Gabbard, the DNI, briefed something similar. Even in the Iraq war days, the rap was the CIA was telling the White House what it wanted to hear, at least on WMD, if not the Al-Qaeda connections. But, but for the CIA director and the DNI director to be dismissed or not listened to at all seems a break. What do you make of that?
So this is, again, I think something that you see as being cyclical with the administration. I mean, Bill Clinton notoriously never got a PDB briefing or rarely got a PDB briefing. Gore got the briefing every day. I believe that was what the rumor is. You see presidents being more engaged or less engaged. And Bill Clinton was, frankly, more involved in, basically the economy. That was his big thing. So I think that presidents paying attention to what's being said by the intelligence community depends on the person in the White House. I personally, as a retired civilian, am concerned that the intelligence community is trying to signal information, and this administration is perhaps not listening to them because it has other ideas. I will also tell you, however, that our job as intelligence officers is to report what we know, what we don't know, and what we assess based on both of those things. Our job is not to make policy. Our job is never to make policy. It's to give the policymakers that information for them to do it. Am I concerned that it seems like, and again, I haven't followed Iran in many years. I mean, I've read the same articles you have. I would say I, as a taxpayer, am concerned that perhaps they're not listening to what's being said to them.
Well, I think it's well-founded now that Trump just ignored the intelligence community's warnings about Iran, and they're all coming out of the woodwork now indirectly in time-honored Washington fashion. You know, I mean, you could almost hear Tulsi Gabbard speaking in that latest piece about, you know, she warned Trump about the downfall, the downsides of attacking Iran and so forth. Anyway, fascinating as this is, we have to leave it here, Steve. So thanks so much for your time and coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media. Do you love badass women of history?
then you need to meet Klondike Kate, the Queen of the Yukon, and her unexpected connection to Tacoma's Pantages Theater. Join Shay and Jody of Rainy Day Rabbit Holes for a special live podcast event Wednesday, September 16th at 7 p.m. at the beautiful McMenamins Elks Temple in Tacoma, Washington. It's a night of storytelling, local history, and a few truly questionable life choices that somehow all lead right back to Tacoma. We'll also be doing a meet and greet from 6 to 6:30 p.m., so come say hi before the show. Get your tickets at rainydayrabbitholes.com and come find out why all roads lead to Tacoma.